Hello and welcome to Preprints in Motion.
Join us as we sit down with early career researchers and discuss their latest preprint and find out about their journey through the muddy marshes of academia. But we don't stop there. Every month we'll be bringing you special episodes with open science leaders where we discuss how to fix academia. Easy, right? So hit that subscribe button, leave a rating, or find us on Twitter at MotionPod. But for now, let's get into the show.
This week we talk to Jason Schmidt to discuss the paywall movie. So join us for a discussion on academic publishing and all that is wrong with it.
It's so great you guys are doing this. This is what a great service.
We were still kind of new to this, and it's a bit nerve-wracking interviewing someone who is a professional at doing this kind of thing. So we'll see how it goes. We kind of make it up.
It's all faking it. The whole game of media is faking it, I'm telling you.
That's our approach so far. So thank you so much for joining us. And it is not very often in academia you come across somebody who has worked on an Emmy award-winning documentary, which is super cool. But that, weirdly, is very different to the documentary we're here to talk about, which is Paywall, the business scholarship. So, I mean, what was that transition? Why did you go from something that was... So the Emmy award-winning one was all about music and rock and looked really cool. It's on my list to watch. Whereas then you've jumped into very, what some might consider, dry sort of academic topic. Why?
So I started my PhD was in oral history. I should go further back. So I worked at Atlantic Records outside of when I got my first job at a University of Michigan. I got, you know, low level position at Atlantic Records and, you know, working for a lot of, you know, artists that were, you know, potentially much more fortunate than I was making, you know, $8.50 an hour and, you know, doing all this paperwork and thinking this isn't really a life that I want to live for like the long term. But I had a lot of contacts and a lot of interview opportunities. And that eventually, you know, I was first generation of my family to go to, you know, undergrad, let alone ever thinking of grad. But so, you know, maybe the dismal side of the media industry inner workings kind of led me to think, oh, maybe there's some other kind of components within media and that might be better served from a master's degree. So, you know, fast forward a couple of years and first time in my life, I'm ever invigorated about higher education because undergrad is kind of a number and kind of scantrons, at least here in the States. So, you know, master's behind me, all of a sudden 4.0 and making sense, looking at cell phone technologies and then, you know, working towards a PhD, dissertation advisor asks, you know, what do you know about? And I knew a lot about Detroit rock. So I did a dissertation on Detroit rock music and why the creativity of that region really was inverse to the creativity of the creativity of the region was inverse to the economics. The economics had always been kind of dismal, in some ways, this kind of goes to the other side of the pond as well, is, you know, look at Manchester or something as well. That was the kind of creativity juxtaposition in music. Just finished the dissertation, got, you know, requested by a high budget documentary, a great film producer, Tony D'Annunzio, who had a really strong track record to be his field producer and interviewer for this, you know, Grandy Ballroom. It's a small club that every single rock icon nearly played in the 1960s. Signed on to that. And, you know, 2 days later, I'm, you know, interviewing all these icons, Slash of Guns N' Roses, Lemmy of Motorhead, Roger Daltrey, and really just like getting all these experiences as the interviewer and seeing just like, you know, what kind of is part of this process of telling a story. And so, you know, that was something that I kind of really, I saw the power and impact that film has. And in a world in, you know, our kind of era, and I'm always telling this to students, you know, being able to create rich media is literacy. I ask my students, when's the last time they read a 300-page book? And regardless of the, you know, the students, not very many have done that recently. Versus, you know, how many have watched strong YouTube and smart YouTube videos too? Not just junk, not just like bubblegum, but like really being informed and using that as a medium. And all of a sudden, it really showcased, I think, the power of rich media. So you tie that thread into, you know, as a journalist, I was really interested in science. I was interested in, you know, access, global South representation, and, you know, come across all these kind of disparities within the access point of scholarship. And, you know, it showed something that needed to be told. And so that's kind of a thread there.
Yeah, no, this is why I love that you did a documentary about this so much, because it's a medium that this kind of thing doesn't often get covered in. and it's such an accessible way of doing it. And I think it kind of, for a large number of people, they kind of get things more when they see it like that, and it's in that kind of format. Whereas, you know, nobody, I mean, this is unbelievably dry stuff when you read about it, and I spend a lot of time reading about it. And it is that other medium just really brings it to life and makes it real and something that people should care about. And they should care about it because it's obscene amounts of money.
And you should care about it. And it's the caring, I think, that changes social movements and gets activation. And, you know, Peter Suber is brilliant, but how many people are really reading top to bottom his books? You know, they're really, you know, strong books, but like, you know, I felt like there was a component there that I could do that other scholars maybe, you know, have passed. And that's putting a narrative and putting kind of like a story arc on something you mentioned. I mean, it is dry. I mean, it's not the world's most intriguing, you know, story, but there's something that I think every person, when they learn about these discrepancies, all of a sudden they say, damn, there is something here and there is something for me to stand out for. And so, I mean, that was, you know, that was worth kind of 3 to 4 years of work to make that for, you know, a broader swath of society to say that.
Yeah, I mean, when people, you know, when you talk to people who are outside of science and they don't know how it all works, and you tell them that you publish a paper, but you pay to publish that paper, and then you also pay again to read your own paper, it blows their mind. Like, it makes no sense and they can't understand it. Or you publish a paper and you don't go out and celebrate. Like, people think, well, are you getting a raise for that? No, we might go to the pub. But no, we're just going to move on to the next paper. And it's amazing. And it's so good to get those people on board with it.
While for-profit businesses, Elsevier and others, are making $25.2 billion a year infused into the system that's constantly kind of, you know, putting budget constraints on scientists and researchers and, you know, kind of the process, is still willing to infuse that type of capital in a world that, I mean, just look at, you know, this conversation we're having here. We're spanning time and space, and this is just the beginning. I mean, we can all do this, and we can all share everything online free of charge. So if we're, you know, aiding and abetting this system, we're really being lazy. And that's, you know, that's in my mind, that's it. And the laziness, I really feel too, you know, I've talked a lot about this. You know, we can talk about preprints. We can talk about, you know, the colors of green open or of access, and that really kind of confuses people all day. But at the point, maybe it is that confusing section that most researchers and faculty don't come to these conversations that I've, you know, done on open access and research and why it needs to change. It's almost exclusively, you know, librarians and those kind of open access offices themselves. And I think that's, you know, that's a major problem. You know, you need to loop in the faculty and researchers. And obviously, whatever we've done up till this point in time hasn't worked very well. You know, we've had some of the smartest minds. We've even had Plan S and all these things. And we've said that, you know, this is the day it's going to be activated. And you know what? That day goes and it continues on. And then it's the next day it's going to be activated. You need to kind of push the hand. And that's why I was so excited about Plan S and still am, you know, to make a mandate and make the mandate from who is the change agent, the people that have the money. It's not the general faculty member. So I think there's a lot of, you know, good that can still come, but you need to activate the larger academic infrastructure. And I think that, you know, one place I'm always saying that needs to happen is the department level. There needs to, and this is something librarians have often come to me and said, well, what can we actually do? I'm constantly saying you need to have an outlet within a library budget that's about educating the faculty. And you take that education. This is like the key germ of what I would say is the most important. You take the education to departments and department chairs and tell them why they're doing it wrong and why they need to be more accessible with the research and not just impact factor driven at the department level, and show them how that can be done. And that's where I think the big change agent hasn't been activated.
Yeah. When you do that as a postdoc, it turns out they don't really like it. So this document, it covers very much that whole landscape of academic publishing and largely focuses on the insane profit margins, as you've mentioned, particularly with Elsevier. And Elsevier are kind of highlighted often as the poster boy for just obscenity in academic publishing, quite rightly. So I was looking up some of the numbers. And so in 2018, I think Elsevier's profits were 33%. Whereas if you look at Google and Apple in the same year, that was 23%, and Microsoft sat at 28%. So these publishing houses are making huge amounts of money, largely from, as you said, our labor. We're doing all the work. We don't get paid for any of it. and it's just they're making huge amounts of profit. And so in 2018, again, Elsevier made over 950 million. And in the UK, the universities collectively spent 210 million on journal subscriptions. And I just wanted to break that down so people can appreciate just how much money that is. So that money would pay for 700 early career researcher fellowships on the standard fellowship rate at the moment, or 6,500 postdocs on our standard wage, or 8,500 technicians, or 3,500 PhD students covering their stipend for 4 years and fees. And it, like, that's an entire workforce that essentially we're pushing out because there's no money for them. But there is money for them. If we didn't spend this money on journals, surely that's where the money would, well, I'm sure it would probably go to vice chancellors, but surely some of the money would work its way down to that kind of level.
And not only would it work its way down, but you'd actually be increasing the access. All of a sudden, Global South, you know, all these communities that could never even dream of access in this world that you're talking about that makes all those possibilities possible, funded. Now you'd also, you would think it'd be one or the other, but no, it's both, right? You're getting all this money and access. Wait, so it's like, it's a win, literally those wonderful win-wins, you know, there's no negative. And we have the technology. I mean, we all operate in that technology daily.
I mean, imagine if we spent that money on, you know, universities in developing countries where they're chronically underfunded. They could do amazing stuff with that money instead. So given that this system is just ridiculous, do you have any kind of easy solution to that system? Is there, of all the people you've spoken to, does anything come up as a nice, easy solution out of this system? Or is it just that we've all got to do quite a lot of hard work to change the culture and our mindset?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's easy. You know, I thought it was easier maybe earlier into my tenure of working on open access. You know, the more I've spoken and the more I've traveled, it's not an easy lift, especially again, going back to Plan S, how well orchestrated that was and how that even didn't completely impact and change the system. I think that, you know, my hope is that the up and coming junior scholars like yourself are, you know, so used to being able to share and have access and understand ways around paywalls and these overarching things that you're not going to stand for not having access. But I've been saying this for a few years, and you would think that the junior scholars of 4 or 5 years ago would have kind of, you know, that would have sort of caught up. And so I'm, you know, I'm sort of a little pessimistic by saying that because, you know, almost a half decades went, you know, through since I've really been championing these, and I really haven't seen that action take place. So, I mean, I think there needs to be more, again, from the academic units. I think there needs to be more from the funders themselves, you know, whether that be through a mandate or just by taking it upon themselves. There is some change, right, that's happening, but it's not enough to enough to undo the powerful shackles that Elsevier has on the whole research cycle, right, from the creation to the dissemination, not even that. So my university, I'm interested in like increasing, you know, my university's like kind of outreach. And that's like one of my charges this year is to like get into kind of outreach measures. So I just did a thing with Times Higher Ed, you know, and how do they rank Times Higher Education? How do they rank the success of every university on planet Earth? Through Elsevier, through the impact factors, the Elsevier, you know? So like, I mean, it's so embedded, right? So, I mean, I'm sitting here listening to this, thinking in the back of my mind how wrong this is, again, from the access side of things. And so it's not an easy lift. And it's not even probably enough just to be aware of it because people have been aware of this for 20 some years. I mean, the open access kind of creation was, you know, early in the, you know, the early 2000s and in 2001, Budapest, actually. So, you know, 20 years later.
Yeah. No, the change, you know, as you said, it is happening, but it happens very, very slowly. And it is very much, from the people I've spoken to, the change is happening from those researchers who are just coming through. But it's going to take a long time before they can affect change. And even then, again, kind of some of the conversations I had with some people, it goes that you've got a group of people who want to change and they want to actively drive that change. But then you also have a lot of people who will just play the system. And as long as it works for them, if they're successful, then their mindset is that the system must work. So there's nothing to change.
And again, from a slightly pessimistic view, you're excited about open access at this stage of your career. And then all of a sudden, 5 years from now, you're going up for a tenure review. And that tenure committee is, you know, is not of your own wherewithal, basing your metrics and your evaluation on protocol that sounds good, right? We stand on the shoulders of those that come before us. That's an amazing kind of concept in academics. until you see sedimented pathways that really create kind of, you know, stark haves and have-nots that are part of those shoulders that we stand upon. And I think society in the last 2 or 3 years has done pretty good at about calling, you know, people out on wrongful everything, right? On wrongful pathways. And, you know, this needs to happen, and this needs to happen to the tenure committee. But again, those are, you know, those are people that are, you know, 50 years old and have been working in this industry of, you know, research or science or whatever, higher ed, for the last, you know, 15, 20 years. Yeah. And so it's a very convoluted process.
Yeah. No, I'm surprised a lot of the social movements haven't bled more into academia. So like the Me Too movement should really, there's so much of that in academia that could have been tackled, and it kind of feels like it wasn't. There was that really cool documentary on Netflix. I can't remember what it was called, but you might have seen that, which was about female scientists. But apart from that, there's not really been anything big about just how messed up academia really is.
Yeah, I think it was Picture a Scientist.
It was, yeah. It was really, really good. So, I mean, you know, you mentioned Plan S. You'll also be aware of DORA. And you know, these are big things, and these are trying to bring about change, but it's so slow. I mean, what were your thoughts on the University of California a couple of years ago and their sort of debate with Elsevier?
First of all, I always used to say I was on the United States of America apology tour, because I felt that Europe was progressing so much faster towards open access and mandates than the United States was. And then I was, you know, so thrilled the UC system really kind of took a hard-edged line on Elsevier and on these on open access mandating that. And that was a real strong win. I mean, that was the largest university system. And then the second largest university system, State University of New York, also followed suit. So we're getting some big movement in the state side. That was, you know, kind of a rosy picture for about 2 years. And then, you know, sure enough, it kind of it backsteps a little bit. Now it's a paid agreement. It's not nearly as, as glamorous as the old one was for Elsevier, but it still creates kind of this have and have not, which is my point. I'm not doing this because of, you know, necessarily the monetary spending towards Elsevier. I'm doing this really towards, you know, the global access side. And I don't think this, by having any university have proprietary access, is doing the global economy good for synergy, right? Yeah. For sharing left and right brains and, you know, making all that kind of muddy water turbulent. And I think that's really important for big innovations to, you know, to help cure things. But, and then one other kind of complicating notion is, I mean, you have a lot of these universities and developing universities, and specifically China, that are trying to really increase their cachet of their research outputs. And so two things: if you get your publication in a high prestige, high impact journal through Elsevier, here is a quarter to a half of your pay as a bonus in cash. Keep up the good work, get us another high impact journal. Because remember, just a few minutes ago, I said Time Higher Ed, that's how they evaluate universities. And if you're a university system trying to get claw higher up that rung, you know, towards some of these, you know, great other research universities around the globe, that's the capacity, that's the currency that you need. And that is a really hard thing to undo when you have a whole government and a whole, you know, culture that's all about that. So there's all these kind of complicating forces that are all of these, you know, from different, you know, perspectives. But then you see, you know, Taiwan, Peru, Germany, to some degree, they've done really strong stances to push towards open access much quicker. And I think that could be, you know, something that a government helps to mandate.
Yeah. I think that, well, that's part of the reason that Europe are generally doing quite well in this, is that a lot of our mandates have come from the funding body. So in the UK, for example, I think all the funding bodies now require everything you publish to be open access. And you could do that through paying the open access fees, which I, as someone who's just done that, is ridiculous. But at least then the work is open. Or you can do it through things like preprinting your work, and then there's an open version. I think Emma's just discovered that some scientists get bonuses for publishing high-impact papers based on your face.
Yeah, I didn't realise that was a thing. I need to have a chat with my boss. Not that I'm publishing any. I would probably preprint anyway and open access, so it doesn't matter so much.
I mean, it's a great incentive. It would work for all of us. So, you know, one of the things you've mentioned is Sci-Hub, and that features quite a lot in the documentary, and we all love Sci-Hub, apart from Elsevier. They don't love Sci-Hub so much. And one of the things that I find really interesting, because, I mean, I'm lucky, I work in well-funded universities where generally we pay these fees, so I've very rarely come across a paper I can't access. But I still tend to use Sci-Hub Well, to be honest, most of the time I read preprints these days. But if I do come to a paper, I usually run it through Sci-Hub. And the reason I do this is also one of the reasons somebody mentioned in one of the people you interviewed said that a lot of people have access, but they still use Sci-Hub because just the UI and the system so much better than the journal systems. You don't have to click a million buttons or go to four different pages, only get back to the first page when you want to read an article. For me, it just, you know, these journals aren't even trying to make a system that is workable. Like they don't seem to be coming at it from a user. Well, they don't seem to have any users, right? They get the work, they host it, and then everything's difficult about it. To get access, the article processing fees are obscene. It's just, who's it made for?
Well, I think Elsevier would tell you they're the largest open access publisher on planet Earth. So maybe it's made for them, which makes sense because they bankroll almost all of the open access kind of conferences and components. It's all, you know, so of course it makes sense that they help to fund all the open access kind of output so that they can help to write the pathways because they see, you know, the component of true open access is a major, major hindrance or competition to their business. Not unlike back where we started this whole interview, I was talking about my time at Atlantic Records. That's when Napster, which was a legal torrent for sharing songs back in the late 90s, early 2000s, that was running rampant in the music business overnight, was almost destroyed. You know, and that was really the thing that kind of, you know, got me out of my initial job there was because of this Napster. And, you know, you saw that. And that was, just, you know, you see a very similar component that we all know could be so easily uprooted if you had community buy-in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so podcast is all about preprints, so I'd be terrible host if I didn't mention preprints. But, you know, preprints come across in the documentary a little bit, but certainly the past few years, they've really exploded. So I've done some of the code work I've done was looking at how preprints have been used during the pandemic. I mean, how do you think the pandemic has affected this whole system? Because our data suggests that there's a huge number of people suddenly turning to preprints. The usage last year doubled in terms of biomedical literature for preprinting work. So, you know, has the pandemic had a lot of benefits, do you think, for this kind of system?
I think the pandemic has shown us all that we have access in our own IP through our own internet pathways outside of the university system, outside of the university authenticity process. I think it's shown that, yeah, that preprints have clearly boomed. If you look at archive.org and the amount of traffic, I mean, it was actually that before the pandemic, but the pandemic has just, you know, rapidly accelerated, you know, but you need the systems to have been built, right? And so the systems are built and they're there to house these. And those are the disciplines that have most had most kind of invigoration in a COVID world. Is those that had the clear kind of UI, as you said, that allowed these preprints to be accessible. And it's still sort of a tricky component to the preprint if you're looking at a actual, you know, database, you know, and making sure that you have that access. So it is, you know, something that I think is a positive that we're seeing these preprints. But, you know, again, I don't think that I realize the title of this podcast, but I don't think preprints in and of themselves are the one thing that's going to overturn this whole system. I think they're a major component that can showcase how we have this knowledge that's not copywritten, but it's just one pathway. And so my hope is that people become, you know, focused on preprints and know to go to those, and then those create more pathways for the larger literature and a continued evolution of that literature as it goes through various, you know, revisions or if it's ever retracted, so that we have that one system that allows, you know, and that retraction is something I'm sure you guys talk about often for other kind of reproducibility kind of concerns with science and integrity ratcheting up, something that, you know, we need to really be mindful of as we're, you know, creating these systems so that they're not just about promotion or displaying the knowledge, but they can just as equally take it down if that's determined as false. And that's another thing that society's been really focused on in the last 2 years, you know, false everything, right? False news, false, you know, content and disruptive or paths for that. So I think that's, yeah, it's an evolution that I think is, you know, something that at least we can get behind and see as a pathway forward.
Yeah. I mean, preprints are, for early career researchers, they're amazing. They're so beneficial for our careers, but we need things like transparent peer review. We need things where, I mean, retractions, I was talking, there was, ASAP Bio are doing stuff around sort of retraction notices recently. And it's in the pandemic, one of the most cited preprints and papers, but I know the preprints, one of the most cited preprints was retracted, but it's still cited a lot. A lot of the published literature, even though it gets retracted, people will still cite the papers. Because I think you read it once, and then if you don't bother ever checking again, maybe I'm being nice, maybe that's why people are doing it. And if you retract a paper, but the preprint isn't retracted, for example, those don't link up. So you've got no idea. If you've only read one of them, you've no idea there's an issue with them. One of our first episodes, we had Michelle Avisar Whiting from Research Square on. So that's a big preprint platform. And she was talking a little bit about how they deal with this, because they've had a lot of this come up with the pandemic where a preprint has been under review, but that review has brought up some concerns about the quality of the data, for example. And she's, it is quite a difficult thing for them to manage in terms of, so she said that what they do is they'll put an editor's note on the preprint to say there's potentially an issue here, and to kind of try and point you towards it and while there's a solution being worked out. But yeah, it's the whole system needs overhauling, unfortunately.
And we need a system where you can, be hopefully just as rewarded for null findings, right? I mean, we're all operating in a system that we only want these really big findings and really attractive topics that gets us on the Cell or Nature or Science. We've heard of that as often like the CNS disease, it's like this, it's like a process that you just want to keep, it's a circular feedback loop. The current system, it needs an overhaul. Absolutely.
I mean, we've seen that a little bit again with the pandemic. You might be aware of Elizabeth Bick, big on Twitter. So, she goes through and she is amazing at finding duplications and dodgy data in papers. But she's now being sued by a famous French scientist, or infamous French scientist, because it turns out a lot of his work is highly questionable. I don't think there's any surprises there based on what he did during the pandemic. But, it seems at the moment that when you do stand up to these things, you're not rewarded, you're actually targeted. And she gets a lot of abuse online from, if she brings up somebody, if she questions somebody's work, she gets an obscene amount of abuse for doing that. And yet we're meant to be science. That's meant to be how science works. We're all taught, as our undergrads or during our PhD, that nothing's right. You've got to question everything and you're building on everything. And yet as soon as someone does that to somebody's work, suddenly there's a horrible negative reaction to it.
And we have a Retraction Watch here in the States is another big service that is constantly showing updates. And I think that they do an amazing job of at least kind of being kind of a watchdog.
That helps a lot. I mean, a lot of the so it's feeding in through what's his name, he created site.org, I think it's site.org, and that can kind of flag up in your reference manager when a paper's been retracted, which is super useful. So it's been a few years since you made the documentary. Has anything changed since then? Have any of your opinions changed since making it?
Well, I thought, as I had mentioned earlier in this interview, I thought the rollout of Plan S would have happened a little bit more swiftly and a little bit more enacted across all platforms. And I was hoping for that. I was also hoping, that the universities that really adopted a strong open access philosophy would have stayed with that. But there's been a lot of backpedaling for those. So I wouldn't say I have a real rosy picture right now. I've seen the players and I've seen the who holds the cards and go on to the stock exchange and look at RELX right now and look at the stock and how it's doing. One time it had a big slip was 1995. Forbes magazine did a piece showing how important it was to create these new online pathways to disrupt Elsevier and its prices, and Elsevier stock tanked and because they thought that was a foregone conclusion. That was 1995, and here we are in a 2021 vantage point, and we're still kind of questioning, the way forward. I think we need more mandates. I think we need more top-down. I don't think we need anything to be gradual. Anytime academics say, we need it to be a gradual implementation, I just want to cry, because the academics are absolutely horrible at business. They're horrible at seeing the full scope. Every academic is focused very acutely on her or his expertise and not the larger equation, and nobody cares. And the academics themselves are not paying for the subscriptions. So imagine if we could all go to a car dealership and not have any idea of what funds were required. We all would go towards, the really luxury brands. And yeah, I'll take the, the heated seat and the air conditioned leather seats too. Yeah, I'll take that, because who doesn't want all the options when their price is no problem? And this is sort of the system we've allowed almost all Western-based scientists and researchers to operate in. And most of them still to this day, even though there's been, you know, tons of open access weeks and all these organizations and, you know, these, you know, philanthropies that have adopted it, still to this day, most researchers and scientists are not sure why she or he should really adopt open access and why she or he should really use preprints. And I think that's a major failure that we've all done. And I think that needs to be, you know, addressed at the university level, the conference and kind of collective organization level, the philanthropy level, the, you know, grants, and just a general kind of knowledge outreach from each university to each university, from the librarians. So that is almost part of their business model, is to inform why and to have a specific kind of date. You need to have a line in the sand to, you know, really have an implementation, or else you just keep on buffering and you never really get the, you know, the file loaded.
Yeah. I mean, this is, I try not to talk to funders too much because I feel I just complain at them, and I'd quite like them to give me money at some point in the future. But this is one of the things I often bring up to funders when I do talk to them, is that they could change the system overnight very easily, and they just don't. Because I think science has a huge lack of leadership. It's just, there's no real leadership anywhere in academia, unfortunately. A lot of it comes from those people who are lower down the ranks, who, you know, it's great what they do and they have a local impact or a small impact, but they can't change the whole system, unfortunately. So just moving on a bit more generally about what you do, how do you get into documentary making? So, I mean, your background kind of leads into that nicely, but what if a scientist want to jump on to make a documentary about something? Is there a good way of getting into that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, I think that in the modern world, anybody could be a documentary filmmaker with very little effort. I mean, there's so many tutorials, so many YouTube, so many, vlogging has become such a kind of common culture for all of society. But it really is understanding the key playmakers and policymakers and having access. I think the way that I was able to get paywall started was that as a journalist, I had written about it quite a bit. And I had got a lot of traction. I had, you know, articles with 400,000 or 500,000 reads that showed, okay, you're onto something. There's a starvation that's really after this content. And, you know, that helped my case for, and it was a very small grant that allowed, you know, me and students to create this. I mean, you're not talking a multi-million dollar, you know, Tom Cruise film or anything. You're talking about a bootstraps operation. But I think that, again, I think this is actually happening. I think more researchers and scientists across the breadth of academic, you know, pathways are realizing that, you know, video helps to promote what they do. I mean, every popular publisher, if you're with Penguin or Random House and you're releasing a new fiction or nonfiction book, what is required from that publisher? But that week that book is released, you're going to do a video talking about, you know, why you created this book and showcasing that. And they're going to put it on all their social channels. And I think a world that, I mean, all researchers are after, you know, the idea of impact factor is impact, right? We want impact of our work. We want people to read it. You know, I don't want the scarcity side of it, but I want people to read it. And so the best way to read it is often through bimodal means, right? Times New Roman works great. And it has worked great from the advent of the Gutenberg press till now. But I think that could be supplemented, right? Gutenberg did a good job. But I mean, I think there's, you know, this new component that we all have a 4K camera in our pocket at all times. And all it takes is a $50 gimbal. And now you have like a major camera operation that's not all shaky, right? You put that camera, your phone in that gimbal, and you can do nice pans. And you even have, you know, somewhat decent audio. And I mean, I think everybody can be, you know, her or his biggest kind of video documentary advocate. And I think there's, you know, major pathways for beginner filmmakers. I mean, you know, Sundance has a great, you know, early career, early filmmaker process that you can take part in, into, you know, in all the Tribeca Film Festival as well. There's really great pathways. And I think that a lot of films love it when there's, you know, kind of a scholar behind it that really knows her or his research better than anybody else, because, you know, that's a cool story to tell. And my big moment was trying to get to a point with, like, you know, this paywall where you get to like that climax story arc. So I was like, you know, how the heck do you make an engaging story with, you know, 50 academics? So I was so thrilled. John Willibanks, who's one of the more charismatic people I've ever met. I mean, he was getting so worked up about access. I loved it. He's, he said, there's, you know, he said the word fuck. And I was like, that's definitely going in my film, because that's a high point to really think. I mean, we're all scholars, we're all focused, but we're also all humans. We want that kind of relationship. We want that kind of emotion. And so it's that combination of, you know, scholarship meets humanity, I think, that really tells a good picture and makes a good story arc.
Yeah. I think we're seeing a lot of, you know, a lot of scientists when they publish these days, we get a lot of those whiteboard videos out now about the paper, or people try and write opinion pieces, which I was lucky enough to do with my last paper. And the opinion pieces are, it's amazing. Like, as a scientist, you often get a couple of hundred people read your paper over a couple of years. Great. But then you do an opinion piece and suddenly like thousands of people have read it and it's been 24 hours. It's just mind blowing as a scientist to do that. And that is, as you said, that is impact. And we should be judged on that, not the impact factors. It's who is reading it. Is it actually having an effect out there?
And most university operations manuals have a kind of ability for all creative output to count towards your scholarship tenure packet. So by spending a day and making a really strong video, that's citable, right? That's CV-able. That can be part of your package. And if I had two different faculty that were applying for a job, and one of them had the ability of kind of showcasing sort of new media skills that helped to show her or his research, and the other didn't, I mean, it's really a no-brainer if you're looking for, you know, again, departmental intrigue or impact or teaching methods. I mean, I think that's a really strong way to show well-roundedness that's going to operate both in the, you know, the lab, but also in the classroom.
Well, I mean, it just comes down to general communication anyway. You know, the best work is not the best work that's done to a technical level. It's the best work that's been communicated well. So with the invention of penicillin is a really good example, right? When that was first discovered, it was wasted because Fleming didn't know what to do with it. He didn't really communicate very well. And it took another group to come by a little bit later and say, well, actually, this is amazing. And they communicated out. And then it took off as this amazing treatment. But you need that communication is the vital part. And often, I think, in science, it sometimes gets a bit forgotten. So I am out of questions. And I think that probably is quite a nice point to end on. We should all get out and do more outreach. I'm all for that. I think I love getting out of the lab. It probably makes me a terrible postdoc and a PhD student. I was a PhD student. But I love getting out of the lab and doing this kind of stuff, because it's always fun to talk to people like you who are really passionate about this kind of stuff. Because this is just, I love doing this. But then it's also really good when I get to talk about my own work and I get to just share what I'm passionate about, because I think as scientists, we love to talk about that kind of stuff. And it's just, we should all be doing more of it.
And from a faculty side, I'm always telling my courses that word passion, right, is so key to help to always evaluate what we're doing and making sure that we are passionate. And my kind of litmus test for passion is if I wake up at 2 a.m. to jot something down. Yeah, out of deep sleep, if I ever, not daily, but occasionally, wake up and, I don't want to forget that and have to write something down, that kind of helps to tell me that I'm onto something that's, you know, kind of passion directed. And I think those, you know, researchers, scholars, human beings that are passion directed eventually are going to, you know, climb that rung. And I'm not saying rungs by like money. I'm just saying the rungs of like, you know, power and impact and like, you know, just societal reform. They're going to often climb that rung higher because they're doing it for that passionate reason versus just doing it as a, you know, process that has to be completed. So that's always something I'm big fan of, is trying to always, you know, align our passions with like a 5-year plan. Where do we want to be in 5 years? And are we doing something every day so that in 5 years we meet that goal? I mean, that's the best way to, you know, you put a GPS coordinate 5 years from now, and every day you should spend, you know, a few minutes making sure that you're navigating that pathway. Or else if you're not, you're often doing convoluted big old S turns, thinking that you're actually getting to the direction you want when you're not. And that makes grumpy old men that say, life's hard, life's tough. You know, nobody wants to be that. You know, we all want to achieve, you know, our goals. And so I think that when our goals can align with our day job, can align with our research, I think that makes for a stronger society. And I think that's going to help us all.
I don't want to say anything else now, because that's an even better point to end on.
I wanted to jump in and ask, I mean, it mainly because we've talked a lot, but I just wanted to highlight, for example, maybe you could highlight to people, maybe like postdocs that are listening, or PhD students are listening, and what is something that we could actually do? Do you think it's going to the department, like doing what Johnny does, go to the funders, constantly questioning them, what do you think, some maybe as an individual, or maybe we should get together, what could we do about this whole publishing issue?
I really think the best impact that everybody has at their own university ecosystems are to link librarian outreach, and every librarian is an open access fan. I've never met one that isn't. Link the librarian outreach to the specific departments and show the departments why they are not fully engaging with this current, you know, in a way that they could with the open access preprint literature that you're, you know, so passionate about. Being that conduit from departments to libraries and showcasing why in your department, I think that's the biggest thing that's missing from this equation. Because then when departments are on board, then 5 years from now, tenure committees are on board, right? Because that junior faculty now is an associate faculty and they're reviewing the next tenure committee. And I think in my mind, that's one of the ways that really needs to flip this system. And it's a hard one because it's very localized, right? It's not just this one red button that you push and the whole world has open access. We've seen that doesn't work. You know, it has to be on a department to department, university to university basis. And then once you have more and more universities that have nearly full adoption, then I think others will follow suit, because most universities are kind of like in this mimic game. Oh my gosh, this university is doing that. Well, then we can too. And it creates kind of a domino effect, I think. So that's some of the strategies I would say.
Awesome. Thank you. Because I was just coming away thinking, what can I do and where can I go specifically to try and help with this, because it's such a big issue.
And there is that open access week every once a year that all these universities really take part in it, and in making sure that you get faculty to actually be part of that open access week, because again, that's like a glaring kind of missing component often, is that faculty voice.
Right. Well, thank you so much for that hour. That was, I loved it. I've had a lot of fun.
You could tell you were getting really passionate about it, Johnny. It was great.
Thank you guys for doing this and standing out in preprint so much. I'm thrilled.
They're great. I love them. I spend a lot of my time these days reading them. But actually, just you were mentioning librarians. When we published when we posted our work and then published it, probably the biggest community that came out to say, this is amazing, were librarians. Because they had something that was sort of evidenced that they could use in their arguments. And they're such a lovely bunch of people too. Like, I think we often don't talk to them very often. We silo ourselves in the lab. But they're really good people and they are amazing at what they do.
That's been one of the coolest parts of the whole process of this movie rollout, is I've got to travel quite broad for this and for speaking. And I've just met so many librarians around the globe. And I've never met a librarian that I don't like. They all are so passionate and they're so driven for the right reasons, but they're also aggravated. I've also never met a librarian that likes Elsevier, not one. So it's this, they're charged. They want to do something themselves. And often they feel like kind of, belittled in the system as well, because they can't activate the change that they so desperately want. Thank you guys. I really appreciate this.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for coming on.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CD, XY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer to everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows. Okay, and that is the show. If you enjoy listening, then hit that subscribe button for more and leave us a review on whatever platform it is you're listening on. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. Didn't enjoy that? Well, we're all scientists here, so send us your review and let us know what works or what you'd like to hear more of, or less of. But until next time, have a good week.